Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's Rick Spezak, News Director for Progressive News Network. Welcome. We've got a great show for you tonight. It's our candidate night show. We've got Shannon Roberts. We have Jeff Clemens and Patrick Murphy, all progressive Democrats vying for your support. And we wanted to bring them out here, give them a chance to talk to you, to make sure that you knew about the good progressive activists that are involved in trying to give you the government that you want, that you need. And now for our headlines. Kira Cowell calls leak prosecution selective and vindictive. Former CIA officer John Kira Cowell, who's charged with unauthorized disclosure of covert officer identity and other classified information, says the case against him is driven by government animosity and that he is the target of selective prosecution. Many of you may know that all of a sudden the Republicans discovered leaks, and that they made a point of calling out the fact that the White House has issued leak after leak after leak after leak, showing what a great, strong leader President Obama is. And, of course, Republicans are no strangers to the self-serving leak, but they just happened to notice it. So they want to investigate. And it puts the administration in an awkward spot because, of course, they have prosecuted more leakers than any other administration in history. Well, that is a bit awkward, but that's okay. There's other issues to discuss. We also want to bring your attention to the fact that the Fukushima plant faces special danger from typhoons this summer. So it's not enough we've got radiation leaking. We've got open exposed rods out there. There's water runoff going into the ocean. Then and gases, and they don't know where to put the dirt. But they are what they call naked pools. Uranium spent fuel pools, number 3 and number 4 reactors, are currently naked, says Kurochao Kudo, a research professor of nuclear engineering at Kyushu University. He says on June 5th, a tornado with winds of 100 meters per second, like the one that just hit Tsukuba, could suck up the pool water, exposing the fuel rods. He raised the concern during a meeting assessing safety measures at the crippled plant. As far as dismantling and decommissioning reactors will take decades, TEPCO should review the plant's safety measures, not only against aftershocks and tsunamis, which of course they were warned about, but also tornadoes and huge typhoons, even if the possibility of extreme phenomena are low, said Kudo, one of the 12 members of the advisory panel to the nuclear and industrial safety. But there's more interesting news there. It seems that Japan has had more tornadoes, downbursts, flurries of winds in recent years as atmospheric conditions have destabilized, said Norio Shimoyama, a weather forecaster at the Japan Weather Association. 37 tornadoes hit Japan in 2010, the most since meteorological agencies expanded its monitoring in 2007, according to agency data. The U.S., about 25 times bigger than Japan, has on average 1,253 tornadoes per year between 91 and 2010, according to the National Climate Data Center. Radioactive water. A tornado strike in Fukushima could damage hundreds of tanks with contaminated water that the utility stockpiles there. Much of the water injected into the damaged reactors is to cool the melted fuel, leaked into the basement of the plant, and now there's nearly 100,000 cubic meters of highly reactive water stored at the plant. But listen, that's okay, because TEPCO plans to install a new water processing system that can remove the strontium and other types of radioactive substances, and they hope to have that done by 2015. Hey, no kidding. The site bristles with tanks holding radioactive water, said Kudo. Fukushima plant may have released some 900,000 terabecquerels of iodine, equivalent to radioactive iodine-131 and cesium-137, into the air at the height of the disaster. Oh, by the way, tornadoes have not been assumed in designs for the Japanese buildings for many years, as they formerly thought that the probability of being hit by a tornado is very slim. And the TEPCO executives have been informed of their own research showing the plant could be hit by a tsunami more than 10 meters high before the station was swamped by powerful waves. And that contradicted earlier claims by top officials, including President Makasaka Shimizu, who said this whole thing was sotogai, which means that they didn't really have a plan for that. It means it was unforeseen. They just hadn't even thought about it. Isn't that good news? Well, fantastic. And from Tom Hartman in Op-Ed News, Republicans stick the knife in the back of American workers once again. U.S. call center industry has lost 500,000 jobs. That's 500,000 to you and me. Over the last 6 years, thanks to corporations like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and T-Mobile, outsourcing American jobs to foreign countries where they can exploit low-paid workers. The big four Wall Street banks have all moved their call centers to the Philippines in the last few years, laying off hundreds of thousands of Americans. These are the same guys who, oh, that's right, they're taking the taxpayer bailouts. And it's been noted that there's something of a lack of enthusiasm of Obama supporters. They're just not turning out like they used to. When you compare the crowds of the inaugural, when so many had so much hope because of the platform that Mr. Obama ran on, yet after a term that's willfully ignored and stuck to the Bush playbook so closely, are they surprised the crowds are smaller? Ignore your supporters at your peril. I guess as long as J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs is safe, he'll have a place to come and rest in January 2013. And whether we assess the environmentalists, pipelines, drilling, Guantanamo, NDAA, whom the Obama team seemed to take special enthusiasm in denouncing. In addition to being too idealistic, civil libertarians, indefinite detention, drone, Arama, and many other progressive constituencies, economic justice, have either been ignored or insulted, or both. So, maybe that's why President Obama and his boys, since he won't even golf with girls, are coming up a little short in the cash drawer. Maybe they might eventually get the idea when you spit on your supporters, sometimes the wind blows it back in your face. Hey, how about that? This, by the way, has been reported to be the most anti-environmental Congress in history. Here's the record. Global temperature changes are rising. Violent weather is increasing. Chemicals in the air, food supply, and water have led to soaring rates of allergies, asthma, certain cancers, hormonal disruptions, male infertility, forest lands vanishing at an unprecedented rate, vast dead zones spreading across the world's oceans. We're running out of our non-renewable fossil fuels. Everybody knows we're facing an unprecedented environmental crisis, right? Well, that's wrong. Everything you know is wrong. This news seems to never have gotten to Americans' Republican legislators. In the face of these huge and escalating threats, the GOP majority over the last year has voted no fewer than 247 times, nearly once a day for every day the House was in session, to weaken environmental protections that have been in place for decades and to defeat needed legislation. This, according to a report issued on Monday by Representative Henry Waxman, a member of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, and Edward Markey, a member of the Committee on Natural Resources. They have called the 112th Congress the most anti-environmental ever. Here's how Waxman and Markey break down the dismal record. 77 votes to undermine the clean air protections, including votes to repeal health-based standards that are the heart of the Clean Air Act and to block EPA regulation of toxic mercury. That's right, we need more mercury in our environment. And other harmful emissions from power plants, incinerators, industrial boilers, cement plants, and mining operations. 39 votes to weaken protection of public lands and wildlife, including votes to halt reviews of public lands for possible wilderness designations, and to remove protection for salmon, wolves, sea turtles, and other species. 37 votes to block action to address climate change, including votes to overturn EPA scientific findings and climate change endangering human health and welfare, to block EPA from regulating carbon pollution from power plants, oil refineries, and vehicles, to prevent the United States from participating in international climate negotiations, and even to cut funding for basic climate science because, of course, they never heard of it. 31 votes to undermine the Clean Water Protections, including votes to strip the EPA authority to set water quality standards and to enforce limits on industrial discharge. Remember the rivers that caught fire? To repeal the EPA's authority to stop mountaintop removal and to block the EPA from protecting headwaters and wetlands that flow into navigable waters. Oops, maybe they were mistaken in thinking that this wouldn't happen. Records from desperate corners of the U.S. show that wells drilled to bury 30 trillion gallons of toxic liquid deep beneath the ground have repeatedly leaked, sending dangerous chemicals and waste gurgling to the surface or seeping into shallow aquifers. But that's okay. There's only 680,000 of these underground wells. Don't forget your thoughts and calls and emails to support Brother Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. By the way, the Ecuadorian president, Rafael Correa, has recalled his ambassador to the UK in order to discuss the case of Julian Assange. The asylum bid is being analyzed without concessions to foreign pressure. Stonewalled. Senator Chuck Grassley is getting stonewalled by the Food and Drug Administration over an inquiry that's been spying on federal whistleblowers. Senate and related House investigations were sparked by a lawsuit filed by six FDA whistleblowers who were allegedly targeted for surveillance. National Whistleblower Centers is representing them in court. Relatedly, the Office of Special Counsel, which also investigates the FDA over the same matter, released a memo this week to federal government urging agencies not to spy on whistleblowers. Doing so, the memo said, might lead the OSC to conclude that retaliation is afoot. And there's nothing we like better than government retaliation on whistleblowers, right? Okay. Another story you should know about. let's see. Storage. Between 2002 and 2009 in the U.S., the number of prisoners in private facilities has increased by 37%. Half of all immigrant prisoners are now in privatized facilities, and the money involved is huge. The two largest prison companies in the U.S. reported $3.3 billion in combined revenue in 2011. Paul Krugman has been following the scandal in New Jersey about those halfway houses, which he's also been following. As Krugman summarizes in his thoughtful article, the New Jersey scandal is almost surely a glimpse of a pervasive and growing reality of corrupt nexus of privatization and patronage that undermines the government across much of our nation. Hey, are you surprised that Scott's government here in Florida has privatized all the prisons south of Okeechobee? I'm sure it's a coincidence. Okay, TPP is treason. Some of you may not have followed the fact that there's been a leak of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. George Orwell cried last night is the way Brett Titley proposed it. He said he had warned them, hadn't they read his books, taught in high school and across America. We have to stop them before it gets to Congress, warned Brooke Harper, referring to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is basically super NAFTA for the whole Pacific Rim. The proposed Pan-Pacific Treaty, likely the most insidious piece of corporate global legislation ever, secretly slipped through the halls of Congress. It was a secret until just 2 weeks ago. Now opposition must quickly rise. The consequences for America, the world, society, indeed, are terminal. Ms. Harper, who represents Global Trade Watch, an organization based in Washington, D.C., has just arrived in San Diego to rally Southern California area activists in preparation for the coming TPP 8-day negotiations to be held at the Hilton San Diego Bayfront in San Diego, July 2nd through the 10th. This is round 13. Gee, too bad we found out, huh? A crowd of about 40 representing the activist groups from the San Diego area listened as Harper explained the depth of the threat posed by TPP. They had gathered at Canvas for Cause, a community hall in the City Heights area. What they heard was chilling and went far beyond the fringes of what our current broken American democracy has become. President Barack Obama, he minces no words, is a traitor. This underhanded legislation treaty secretly sells out the American people's legal rights in favor of the corporate puppet masters. The concept, inception, and mechanism of the TPP treaties come solely from the Obama administration. In doing so, our one-time constitutional scholar president attempts to create... Hold on 1 second, ladies and gentlemen, put on some music, and I'll be right back with you. Hello? Yes? Oh, my goodness. I'm good. I guess we'll bring you on this way. Are you having trouble getting through to the official number? Yeah, I'm not seeing it. Okay, then tell you what, I will try one more time, and if you don't get through, then just call me back on this one. Okay? Thanks so much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it seems we're having a little trouble with the sign-in system of the radio station. So hold on 1 minute. We're going to try a workaround. And we just got that first call from Miss Roberts, and she's going to try to get in again. And hopefully she'll make it back in. Also want to mention another controversy that's very unusual. There's a website supporting the protest actions at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. And the website is called WallStreetSouth.org. But just recently there was a document put up called the Charlotte Principles. And there's a story on this in Op-Ed News that you might probably want to look at. The curious thing is this... This piece was put up on their website, basically calls for a range of tactics, and it also, and that's not so bad, because a range of tactics is always useful, but some people have opined that this is also code for violence and destruction is acceptable. I think that's Shannon, so let me do a little magic here, and we'll get her online. Shannon, welcome.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing this evening?
Very good, very good. So glad you could come make it on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's quite an honor.
Well, thanks so much. You know, why don't you first tell us a little bit about yourself? And I always like to ask my guests one particular question. You know, it's so difficult nowadays just to make a living, to raise a family, to live one's life. I think it takes something special when somebody says, okay, in addition to trying to do all those things, I'm also going to try to make a difference. Could you talk a little bit about your background and what made you sign up to try to make that difference?
Oh, I'll be glad to, Rick. Right now, I'm running as the Democratic candidate for the 2012 Congressional District 8 race in Florida, just to let you know that. And as far as background, I am a retired federal executive, having worked at NASA and the Departments of Justice and Transportation in Washington, and also the President's Council on Management and Improvement. So I have an extensive background, in particular in the federal government level, and also I've worked with the state of North Carolina, and I was a city council member in Cape Canaveral for 4 years. I was also the 2010 Democratic nominee for this seat, although with the redistricting, that was the former Congressional District 15, and now we're Congressional District 8. Which is all up the Vard, Indian River, and a little bit of Orange County on the east side. And as far as what made me decide to run, I've always been a public servant at heart. And, you know, both my professional and my academic background has been in public service. And in that way, I thought having had the experience that I've had, you know, particularly in the executive branch, you know, at the federal, state, and local levels, I thought I would have the background, particularly as a career executive, we have to work across party lines. And I really do believe that I can make a difference working in the Congress, supporting the president with a progressive agenda, and helping both the nation, the state, and our immediate district here in Florida.
Oh, that's great. Where did you grow up?
Well, I'm originally from Georgia, and I'm a dependent, military dependent. My dad was in the Marine Corps. And in the Army, served in World War II, so he's a decorated war veteran. And we traveled around the country, living in California, New Jersey. We also had some experience in France and in Ethiopia. So at an early age, you know, I learned to, you know, live and study and work in different parts of the country and the world. And it's been a wonderful experience. So I'm very grateful for that.
Certainly given you a breadth of experience with people.
It has, and I think in that way, I'm sure a lot of the minority dependents that listen to your show understand that advantage of being able to, you know, pick up and leave and then establish roots in new locations and have the joy of meeting new friends and keeping in touch with those that you've met and known along the way as well.
Well, that's great. I understand you did some work with NASA?
I did. I worked at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. for about 7 years, and then here locally at Kennedy Space Center for 7 years, where I was the Director of Workforce and Strategic Planning, among other positions, really helping the agency plan forward. And as we know, President Obama has had a very progressive agenda, I think, for the America's Space Program. I think he was very visionary in helping us transition from the shuttle program to what's now an emphasis on deep space exploration and the commercialization of space transportation, which is really the wave of the future. Much as it's done, you know, with air travel and rail travel, the government was usually in the lead in the beginning, you know, and then, you know, became, you know, an active, I'm so sorry, my other phone in the background here, but the lead of the government usually is in the research and development stages, and then the government usually moves away towards its direct role in research and development and becomes more, you know, focused in enabling the private sector to get involved. So that is a good thing.
Well, it must have been really amazing to work at NASA. So many of us who grew up in the late 50s and 60s saw, you know, that Cold War rivalry turn into just an amazing scientific adventure for the whole planet, really, I think. Whether you're talking about the race to get an orbital vehicle and, of course, the space station and the moon landing. Obviously, you've got to be a big proponent of a future evolving space program. If you had your druthers and you were still steering NASA's future, would you see more space stations? Would you see a lunar colony? Would you see the attempts to make that Mars landing of humans?
Oh, absolutely, Rick. I think that going back to the moon may be part of the journey, but I think the president has given the destination for deep space exploration to include, you know, going to Mars. And a lot of our current efforts, particularly the government role with NASA, is towards developing those higher technology levels that will enable us to go to Mars and live there. And then, understandably, to reach out even to asteroids and learn from that with robotic exploration as well. So it may involve a lunar, you know, colonization to help us learn how to live, you know, in space before we actually travel to Mars, because that's so expensive at the current level of investment. But, you know, we'll learn a lot along the way, and I think that part of going to Mars is challenging us to be bold and to actually develop those technologies that will help us move from the moon to Mars and on, you know, to deep space.
Well, you know, since you've been a planner and working on developing long-term goals, I think that puts you in a really interesting vantage point to look at resource allocations for the country. And I know, speaking for myself, I won't speak for you, but speaking for myself, I think we need to re-up on that investment in science and technology. I'm not crazy about the idea of outsourcing our space travel to private industry. Obviously, there are benefits from it, but I think there's a real benefit also for making that a national commitment. Could you weigh in on that?
Well, I think it's a blend of both, and I think that's the exciting thing about the president's agenda. He's actually enabling us to have that leadership in research and technology development, which is what you're talking about, and still enabling the private sector to get involved, particularly in low Earth orbit endeavors. But I'm like you. I think there's so much of a spin-off benefit for space exploration as it relates to science, engineering, and math, which understandably, as a country, we're going to have to propel ourselves forward to, you know, continue to be a world leader in that regard. So NASA is one of the best investments I think the country can make as it relates to challenging our youth and enabling us to develop technologies that benefit the quality of life here on Earth and then enable us to continue our heritage as explorers. You know, certainly space is our next frontier, and I think that's what we continue to build upon.
Well, my last question on this topic, because it's one near and dear to my heart. But I remember in the early 60s and throughout the 60s, there was a real drumbeat to see American youngsters, American school children, get into math, get into science, get into the hard sciences, from mathematics and physics through the biological sciences. And I can't help but admit a certain trepidation when I hear how many congressmen and how many Americans seem to have lost an appreciation for the sciences. I find it very troubling.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Ray, because the investment, you know, in science, it has incredible rewards towards the knowledge that we gain from that. And I think, as you're pointing out, I think the more we focus on investing back in the country, back in the world, you know, in terms of all the things that science provides in terms of new knowledge and development, you know, that comes from that knowledge, I really do believe that in Congress we have to have a special appreciation for that and not lose sight of the fact that we have to invest. It's not only reducing our expenses, but we have to, on one hand, reduce expenses, but on the other hand, continue to invest in the modernization and discovery that our country is, you know, through the ages been known for being the leadership.
Well, thanks so much for that topic. Let's talk for a minute now about Florida. Obviously, there's more troubles than you could list on three hands, that's for sure. What do you see as some of the priorities that you'd like to see your time be invested in to help out our neighbors here in Florida?
Well, understandably, is the jobs and the economy, I'm sure, is number one on all of our lists. And anything we can do, particularly here on the Faith Coast, where we've had a transitioning shuttle program workforce, we really do need to bring in that new business, you know, to this district. And in that regard, I'd be a very active representative working with my Democratic congressional colleagues to try to bring those opportunities to our area. Secondly, clean energy. Here we are, the Sunshine State, and I know all of us would be so proud of Florida taking the lead in alternative clean energy initiatives, and that would be something else. Again, because of my background in Washington, I believe that I would be very effective working as a federal colleague, you know, with the federal agencies that are involved in bringing those resources back here.
Well, with all those sidelined engineers and scientists from the former space program, it seems like we should be able to put those people to use, given the technology challenges we find ourselves in right now.
Absolutely, Rick. You're absolutely right. And I could mention on the final note, transportation. As you may know, the Space Coast is the only place in the world that has five modes of transportation, you know, an air, rail, road, sea, and land, because we have Port Canaveral here. So I think in that regard, we've got a unique opportunity to bring to Florida worldwide opportunities that will benefit the state, you know, in terms of its world leadership and opportunities in transportation. So, again, I'm just highlighting the strengths that Florida has and the opportunities that we have, that we really need to have progressive leaders in Congress to help bring those resources and opportunities back to our state and our respective districts.
Well, that's wonderful, and we certainly appreciate your perspective on that. Let me ask you about one of the challenges that's going to be facing us all, regardless of how the Supreme Court rules on the healthcare system. What do you see as a sensible path ahead for healthcare for Americans, whether or not the Supreme Court rules unconstitutional the president's current plan? What do you think makes sense for Americans?
Well, I know comparatively, I'm sure you probably commented on this in your show previously, that, you know, considering the world leaders in healthcare, the United States has a long way to go. And I think the president did take a tremendous step in the right direction to provide health care for more citizens than we would have ordinarily, for sure, now. So I think in that regard, it was a great first step. And regardless of the Supreme Court decision, I think that the Congress needs to continue to move forward with providing as much as it can universal health care for all in this country. You know, part of our Constitution says, you know, the welfare, the general welfare, and that to me includes caring for each other, and this should be a basic provision and service that we should provide our residents, and that's something that I would hope that we continue to build off of what the president has done and move forward, certainly not go backwards and deprive our citizens of this very basic need.
Well, thank you. Let me ask you another question, if I may. You know, we hear so much from our Republican friends about the problem of the deficit, the problem of the deficit. And it seems to me that the framing of this issue is so important, because what is a deficit but an expenditure, or at least the evidence of an expenditure, an evidence of a priority? You, as a person who spent professional years as a planner, as a person who was allocating resources, when you look at government expenditures, obviously expenditures create deficits at some point, but it's about priorities. Do you see, if as you get involved in the federal priorities, what emphasis would you see changing? I'm wondering, do you see our foreign policy as a place where resources might be repurposed?
Well, I think that the foreign investments can be done in a very constructive, collaborative way, in which we are thinking more globally, which, you know, again, as a country we do, although we need to bring jobs back here to the United States. But as it relates to deficit reduction, I think there's no doubt that we can be smarter, you know, with our government, our use of our government resources. And I do believe that we can do smart investments with our international partners that would be collaboration, such as we've done with the International Space Station. As you know, we've got 16 countries involved in that. So in that regard, I think there are, you know, some investments that we can collaborate upon that will bring returns, you know, to all of the nations that are involved. And as far as the government resources are concerned, I just think it has to be a balanced approach between cutting down, you know, on our traditional ways possibly of doing business, being smarter about it, saving, you know, money where we can. There's certainly, in my years in government, I know that there are opportunities to save, you know, just save a little return. And I think we have to be vigilant, you know, with the federal workforce to look for those opportunities. And then in turn, invest, you know, as a partner with private sector in the infrastructure of the country, you know, so that we start getting returns on that investment that indeed help our, you know, our government and our economy.
Great. If there was one comment you'd like to make to the good progressives out there to help them understand what you want to do, why don't you tell us how you see your own plan for your seat in Congress?
Well, first of all, I want to thank all the progressives, because you really provide us a great deal of heart, those of us that are running, you know, on a progressive agenda and platform, you know, for the congressional seat. So thank you for that. And if there's anything I would commit to all of you to do, is to be a progressive leader in Congress. And that would not only be on behalf of the district, but it would be on behalf of our state and also the nation as it relates to moving the country forward, you know, not backwards. And I think there are so many opportunities for us to plan for a progressive future in so many areas, be it health care, social security, transportation, energy, space, you name it. I think we've got so much of an opportunity before us, and I pledge to you that I will do everything I can to continue that agenda that all of you are setting forward, and myself included, to help the United States continue to be the progressive leader in the world that it needs to be.
Well, you know, Ms. Roberts, I have to thank you and tell you, you have our full support. If there's anything we can do to help you. You know, a lot of people talk a good game. We've seen too much of that. But I've seen you there at meeting after meeting, participating, showing up, and I know where your heart is, and we're with you. So if there's any other way we can help you, you let us know, okay?
Thank you, Rick, and your hearts keep us moving forward, so thank you so much.
Okay, you have a good night.
You too, Rick. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Ms. Shannon Roberts running for office, for congressional office out of the Melbourne area, the new 8th Congressional District, including Brevard, Indian River County, and some of East Orange County. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Looks like we are going to have troubles with our phone lines tonight, but we're a resourceful bunch. We will work around it and find a way to get these people in. So if you hold on 1 second, let me put some music on, and I'll be right back with you. Thank you. The team at work, and we're going to use an alternative number, so things will be worked out anyway. I also want to take this opportunity to thank my co-producer, Miss Mickey Royce, an astoundingly good professional who has her own firm, Media Goddess Worldwide, who does public relations and media relations. One of our co-sponsors, along with Imagineering Productions Full Service Web Media and web marketing. Okay, another topic I want to bring up while we're here waiting for our next call is the exciting topic of the, in addition to the Fukushima tornado problem, they also have additional leaks that are coming off it. Okay. And one of the additional challenges with Fukushima is that there's a profound reluctance to track this information and give it to us. So we have to make sure that we get the facts that we need. Here we go. We've got one of our guests calling in. I think we've got Mr. Clemens. Good evening. Is this Jeff?
It is.
Good evening, sir. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hey, it's so good to hear you. And thanks for going the extra mile and doing our little technical workaround.
No worries whatsoever. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. Jeff, you know, one of the things I like to ask my guests is what took you from being a just another consumer, just another person, you know, going about trying to live their life? What was it in your life that made you pick up the cause and decide that you were going to participate in making this a better world?
Well, it was a complete accident. I just got involved in my neighborhood association, like so many people do, trying to make make a better neighborhood to live in. And that led to getting on a couple of volunteer city boards. And lo and behold, we got some things done on those city boards. And I found that it was something not only that I enjoyed, but that I was good at. So after that success, I was asked by many people here in the city of Lake Worth to run for mayor. And I did. And during my almost 3 years as mayor there, we got a lot of great things done in the city, which led to me deciding to run for the House. So it wasn't anything that I really ever wanted to do for a living. It's something I kind of fell into a little bit. and found that I really enjoyed it, and I liked the process, and I enjoy being able to help people, as much of a cliche as that sounds like.
Well, you know, there's a reason these things are repeated. There's a reason why these things become cliches. But I think from everything I've heard about your process and what you've done with Lake Worth and your time in office, you have been very engaged, and you've made a lot of people's lives better. And I want to congratulate you for that. I was wondering, I've got a list here from your website of some of the committees that you're on. Could you talk a little bit about the State Affairs Committee? I understand you're ranking Democrat there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the only freshman who is a ranking member of a full committee. There are 10 full committees in the House and then many subcommittees underneath them. State Affairs is a full committee that deals with the operation of state government. And so it is the committee that a lot of these nasty anti-government bills come through, including the pension bills that we saw last year and that horrible House Bill 1355, the the voter suppression bill that came through my committee last year as well. So it puts me in position, or it put me in position to really be a voice for progressives and really be a voice against some of the things that Governor Rick Scott is doing. So I've been really happy to serve on that committee, obviously having worked in local government. I'm familiar with how government works and when it can work and how it can work for people. And it's frustrating at times to see what Tallahassee wants to do to local government and to public education. But it's great sitting on that committee and that you get to really fight the battle for people.
Well, that committee, obviously, for so many state issues, is where the rubber hits the road. And you've done a really excellent job in the minority position trying to fight these battles and trying to bring these issues to a head and shine some light on them, and that's fantastic. I was going to ask about your work on the Energy and Utilities Committee. Do you see any progress on alternate energy? Here we've got FPL, record profits, paying no taxes, now wants an increase in their rates. Now, obviously, that's the Public Service Commission, but you must have some insight into that as well.
Yeah, very minor progress. Obviously, anybody who served as the mayor of the city of Lake Worth learns more about electrical distribution and generation than probably they ever wanted to know in their life. And I was able to take that to Tallahassee and hit the ground running. The committee in the House had 15 members, 12 of which were freshmen. And as the only freshman who had been a part of running an electric utility before, I was able to kind of use my knowledge to further some issues up there. But there hadn't been any meaningful energy legislation passed in Tallahassee in 4 years. And this year we did pass a bill, House Bill 7117, that does give the smaller guy a little bit of an opportunity to compete with the big companies. And I was very supportive of that bill. I'm a co-sponsor and worked very hard to make sure it was passed. And interestingly enough, the governor never even signed it. He just allowed it to become law without his signature, which is kind of his way of passing the buck. But at least it's now law, and the little guys will at least have a little bit more of an opportunity to compete against the big guys. But
speaking plainly, that sounds a little bit short.
There is not enough of a push for alternative energy. And it's not only a green issue, but it's also an economic issue and a homeland security issue. We get 50% of our power in the state of Florida from natural gas. And so that is projected to increase to 70% over the next 15 years. It's really just not a stable market. If natural gas happens to spike for one reason or another, if they find that fracking is dangerous, we're all going to be in a whole heap of trouble in terms of our electricity prices. So we really need to look towards these other means. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing more solar and wind in Florida.
Well, that's for sure. They do call us the Sunshine State, obviously not for our solar power.
Exactly. But it could be that way. I mean, you look to other countries and see what they're doing, and certainly Germany's been a leader. But other states have been as well. And New Jersey, interestingly enough, has a fantastic rooftop solar program. And that kind of model of distributed energy is really the future, but obviously it eats into the profits of the companies that run our electrical system right now. So it's a constant battle and push and pull in Tallahassee.
Well, I think it's interesting when I hear FPL tout the fact that they're one of the largest wind farm electric companies, and yet they haven't seemed to do too much here in the Florida area.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have to create the structure at the state level that kind of pushes companies into doing these kinds of things. And unfortunately, we have a very laissez-faire approach to how we decide to deal with energy in the state of Florida, and that puts the ball in the energy company's hands. And you know, I just think that we need to do a much better job of creating a framework at the state level that requires us to look more into the future. I think that's not only the right thing to do in terms of our environment, but it's the right thing to do economically as well. We can create a ton of jobs if we're able to create a more distributed model of how people get their energy and have, you know, rooftop solar and things within communities that generate energy as opposed to a centralized energy source.
I wanted to also ask you to address the Health and Human Services Access Committee work that you do. It seems to me that with all these the cries of deficit we hear from our Republican friends, that human services are probably getting a pretty big budget hit. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. In the last couple of years, we've taken big budget hits, and the folks in Tallahassee do not want to look at new streams of revenue and try to find ways to be able to fund much-needed programs. And so what have we done? You know, in 2011, we cut K-12 education by $1.3 billion. And then this year, higher education took a $300 million hit. And healthcare for seniors and kids took a big hit as well. So we're balancing our budget continually on the backs of people who really can't afford it. And in the meantime, we're doing things like giving $800 million in corporate tax breaks, which is what we did this year. And we have Democrats voting for that. It's very frustrating to see Democrats voting for corporate tax cuts when we're cutting funding to public education.
Well, that's why we're very happy to support our few progressive Democrats who are actually doing the people's work instead of the corporate bidding. So we want to thank you for the hard work that you're doing.
Well, absolutely. A couple weeks ago, I fired off a letter to Attorney General Bondi talking about the influx of corporate cash and how we should be joining with Montana, which is defending its own anti-corruption law that's been on their books for 100 years that deals with corporate influx of cash into campaigns. And 22 states have joined Montana to try to fight the effect of the Citizens United decision on their law. Florida's not one of them, and as of yet, I still have to receive a response from the Attorney General on that issue.
Well, that's a surprise, I'm sure.
Yeah, I guess it's not a surprise. You know, Republicans, you expect them to do these kinds of things. What's frustrating especially here in Southeast Florida is when we have Democrats that are doing those kinds of things as well. We have Democrats that are taking money from these big insurance companies, big businesses, and being endorsed by, you know, organizations like the Florida Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries. These are the organizations that fight against the working class people in Tallahassee. So it's frustrating enough when Republicans do that. It's maddening when Democrats do that.
Let me ask you, you've served on the Joint Select Committee on Collective Bargaining for 2 years. When we see so many times jobs of civil servants under threat, under attack, especially collective bargaining for these people, people we used to call civil servants are now seen as something else by this the big megaphone of Republican money. What kind of challenges do you see in that arena?
Yeah, you certainly have a certain amount of Republicans and even a few Democrats in Tallahassee that seem to be anti-government, and so much so that you hear people saying things like, well, we need to starve the beast. And I'm still having trouble figuring out who the beast is. Is it public school teachers? Is it cops? Is it firefighters? I mean, who or what is this beast that we're talking about? Is it having, you know, safe roads or safe schools? You know, beaches that we can go play at, parks that our kids can go to. I really don't understand what the beast is, but it's frustrating to me to be in Tallahassee and hear people talking about that these rollbacks as a result of our inability to find new revenues is just a starving of the beast. I don't understand that. And if you really don't believe in government, you probably shouldn't be a part of it. So you know, it's going to Tallahassee is a unique experience, and I love it, going up there and fighting that battle. But we need some more good Democrats up there who are fighting that battle with us.
Well, we want to help you every way we can. I was going to ask you, I heard Representative Gail Harrell speak in Stewart a couple years back, and she was assuring everyone who would listen that we could just cut taxes and cut taxes and cut taxes and cut taxes, and there'd be no impact whatsoever on any state services. And she asked, were there any questions? And I said, it seems to absolutely fly in the face of the obvious. How can you continue to cut revenue and not see a corresponding cutback in public services? There's no logic there. And unfortunately, there are many people that are prepared to, you know, listen to that droning voice and accept it at face value rather than do any serious thinking about it.
I mean, the thought process, the general thought process on our side is, well, you know, they're just so invested in this no new tax pledge that they don't see the forest for the trees. But I happen to think it's a little bit more insidious than that. I really do believe that this approach of starving government has to do with moving services into the private world, and has to do with, you know, privatizing our public schools and privatizing our services and killing unions. I think that's the goal. I think they tried to get rid of great programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and then they realized, you know what, people like those programs, and they couldn't get rid of them. So instead of trying that tack, they've now moved to the other side, where they figure if they can just shrink revenue enough with this no new tax pledge, and not only that, but give corporate tax cuts out, give away public school money to private schools, and really make it almost impossible for government to function properly, then their argument for the fact that government is failing becomes a reality. So, you know, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's somewhat scary. And, you know, that's why I'm running for Senate. I mean, Senate is where a lot gets done in Florida. I want to make sure that, you know, I'm over there fighting for the right things, because there are too few people who are.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. You work on the Transportation and Highway Safety Subcommittee. Have there been any studies on infrastructure aging, so to speak, or as long as we don't study it, then we don't know what's going on?
There haven't been any statewide studies specifically on you know, infrastructure as a whole. Certainly, we look at, you know, our bridges and roads on a regular basis, but, you know, our transportation infrastructure and what's underneath that transportation infrastructure, things like, you know, sewers and drainage and water and all those kinds of things, you know, that's starting to age, especially along the coasts in Florida. And we certainly saw that when I was the mayor of the city of Lake Worth. But yeah, infrastructure is what makes the world go around. And it's not the sexy kind of projects that we love to do, but it's important. It's something that we should be paying attention to. And it costs money. You know, we hear about wanting to restrict government revenues to 3 or 4 or 5% every year. And sounds like a great idea. But what if the price of concrete is going up by 12% a year? What if copper is going up 11% a year? I mean, those are real figures. And so what we do is we basically make it more difficult for government to pay for its services year after year after year. No one's talking about this in Tallahassee. And, you know, we need to have adult discussions about how we're going to deal with our revenue issues and deal with our aging infrastructure issues. On top of that, all these unfunded mandates that we pass down to municipal governments and county governments make it difficult for them to be able to do their jobs. And we're starting to see that now. If you look around our communities, parks are not in the same shape that they were 5 years ago. The roads are not in the same shape that they were 5 years ago. We're starting to see, you know, cutbacks on public safety. I think it is going to have an impact. Unfortunately, that impact might not come until it's too late.
I mean, I've been down here since 67, and so much of the public roadways, especially along the coast, goes back to the 40s and 50s. And maybe the expansions of the 60s certainly has a part, but that stuff is aging. That's 50 and 60 year old material now, and clearly there's an awful lot of infrastructure that must be in literally dangerous shape.
Yeah, I think that the state does try to put a chunk of change towards these kinds of things every year, but we also raid the trust funds. You know, there are trust funds that are set aside for transportation, and we go in and we use those to help balance the budget. And the ironic thing about that is there's only one trust fund in the state of Florida that has protection under our laws that can't be swept. Do you know what it is?
No, what is it?
It's the gun trust fund.
Ah!
No. Yeah, that's the only one they can't sweep from. And what's interesting about that is, even though I'm not a proponent of guns, I probably would have voted for it because I believe a promise is a promise. If you tell people you're going to use money for something, you charge them a few extra bucks when they pay their dollars, and you tell them it's going to be used for something, you should use it for that. And whether it's the gun trust fund, the transportation trust fund, the affordable housing trust fund, that's what those things should be used for. And we sweep them all except for that one every year.
Well, I want to thank you so much. You've covered so much terrain for us, and we really appreciate that. I'm going to give you a few minutes now to talk about your agenda, what you see ahead, and what are your priorities for the coming term after you're elected by a resounding majority, sir.
I appreciate that. Well, again, we didn't talk about it too much at the beginning, but you know, I represent West Palm Beach, Palm Beach, Lake Worth, and a bunch of other municipalities in the Florida House right now. But I'm running for the new Florida Senate seat here in Central Palm Beach County. It's a brand new seat that runs from the northern tips of Boynton Beach up through Lake Worth, West Palm, Riviera into Lake Park, and from the ocean all the way west out to just past the Turnpike in certain areas. And you know, the reason I'm running for it, frankly, is there's only 40 senators in the state of Florida. They carry a tremendous amount of weight when they go to Tallahassee, and that's where a lot of bad bills go to die. The parent trigger bill died in the Senate last year. The prison privatization bill died in the Senate. You know, I want to be able to go and affect that kind of legislation. On top of that, you know, my opponent, even though he's a Democrat, you know, votes for school vouchers. He votes for corporate tax cuts. He votes with Rick Scott's, you know, education agenda. And that's frustrating for me to see, and I don't think we need another go-along Democrat in Tallahassee from Palm Beach County.
Well, thank you so much, and please keep us informed. If there's anything we can do to help, you let us know.
I appreciate that. Thank you, and you know, anybody who wants to get in touch with the campaign, it's jeffclemens2012.com.
Okay, you want to leave a number, too, for your office?
Absolutely. It's 561-779-7997.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. We sure appreciate you coming.
Thanks for everything you do. I appreciate it.
Okie doke, and best of luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Jeff Clemens, who's going to be one of your Florida Progressive Democrat senators after this next election. And those of you who will be voting for him, make sure that you know that he's the progressive in the race and that you give your support and your dollars to Mr. Jeff Clemens, moving from the House to the Senate. Hold on just one moment. Good evening. Is this Mr. Murphy?
Yes, it is.
Fantastic. Welcome, Patrick. Welcome.
How you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. Welcome back again. We're so happy to have you.
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand you've got some good news.
What's that?
Well, your endorsement and the support you've gotten?
Yes, we've gotten a lot of great news recently, starting with the poll that we released about a month ago that had Alan West and I tied by 45. It's about 4.5 months to go. That was great news. It won that grassroots challenge. So for all Democratic races out there, the campaign of most grassroots support, and it just won the League of Conservation voters Conservation online. Got some recent endorsements from AFL-CIO, SEIU, Teamsters a few weeks ago. So yeah, we've had a lot of exciting things happening recently.
Oh, that's fantastic! And sir, among other things, you have got to be the Democrat with the strangest lunatic opponent who's running this term. What can you say but Alan West?
Yes. And you know, that's funny you say that, because you know, I don't like to point fingers much, but when I do walk around and meet voters in the district, one thing they all say is, oh, you're running against Alan West, is that the crazy guy? You know, that sort of shamed himself, and I don't think he's trying to change that. So you know, it is interesting the comments he said and the way he's positioned himself. And I truly believe that he believes, you know, he's not saying it for attention necessarily. I think he really believes some of the stuff he says.
Well, you know, I think on another level, I mean, this is as much as we might think of him as a joke and some of these positions he stakes out are just ridiculous on the face, he is backed by serious, serious money and players who really want to steer this country in absolutely, I'm going to call feudal direction. I think that you're fighting a hell of a good battle. And it again, you know, you're known by your friends, you're known by your enemies as well. And you must be mighty proud to have an enemy like that.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Alan West is getting a lot of support from a lot of people that see a much different America than you and I would probably see. And, you know, unfortunately, they want to bring us back to the same failed policies of President Bush. You know, they want to do it on steroids. And unfortunately, what we have now with these super PACs and, you know, some new rules, you know, these people think that our country's for sale. The fact that Donald Adelson wants to spend hundreds of, you know, millions of dollars to what he thinks is buying an election is pretty scary. You know, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, it's pretty scary to think that you have people out there with that, so, you know, those sorts of resources willing to get involved in politics to that degree.
Well, you know, Democrats have never been known as the party of big business or deep pockets. And even though there are some yellow dog Democrats or blue dog Democrats, whatever you want to call them, that do run the corporate game, we are very proud to have you, an honest progressive, running in this area, and we want to tell you that you have our full support.
Well, that's really the you know, we're going to, because you know, we're going to need to unite as Democrats and really as Americans to get this country back on track. And you know, this fringe that Alan West is appealing to, this fringe Tea Party movement, you know, that he continually excites, isn't where the country's at, and it's certainly not the path to get people back to work in our country.
Well, you know, we've got these people who don't want to talk about science, who don't want to talk about women, or at least they want to legislate about women without having women be involved at all.
Right.
And this is the kind of vanguard that West represents. You know, we talked a little bit about just generalities. Why don't you talk a little bit about what your agenda is, what you're going to be bringing to your seat in Congress?
Number one, it's jobs. It has to be the focus of, I think, any person in the country. The Treasure Coast and Northern Palm Beach area is no different. You know, I walk around every day and meet voters and just look for work, and it's sad. And there are certain things the federal government needs to be doing, and that needs to be the focus. And the American Jobs Act, I think, was a step in the right direction, you know, focusing on building roads, bridges, and schools right here at home, you know, not halfway around the world. And focusing on infrastructure and credit to businesses of all sizes. You know, right now, unfortunately, our country, there's such a connection right now between Wall Street and Washington, D.C. It's a shame, because the small business person is really suffering. The mom-and-pop store doesn't get, you know, these lines of credit, doesn't get all the access. They don't get the fancy lobbyists and a tax provision written for them and all the benefits that these major corporations get. And, you know, being an auditor and being a CPA, you know, my job is to go to these, you know, many Fortune 500 companies, look through their financial statements, and that combined with an understanding of the tax code, you could just see, you know, what they were getting away with. And, you know, people like to talk about that Democrats are for this class warfare, and to me, it's not about that. It's the fact that the average corporate tax rate in this country is unsustainable. You know, we cannot have the GEs of the world or the Shells or big oil paying 0% in taxes. That is simply unsustainable. So we have a lot of work to do as far as getting people back to work. I think there's also some local, you know, opportunities that need to be addressed. I don't know how familiar you are with the district, but there's a port up in Fort Pierce that's a great opportunity to create jobs. You mentioned science a minute ago. You know, this is also coined as the research coast. So you have Scripps, you have Max Planck, you have Digital Domain, you have a lot of companies that have come to this area, and you know, they have great jobs, well-paying jobs, and that's the sort of thing that we need to continue to push in our country and in this district. You know, and in addition to jobs, there's a lot of, you know, major fundamental pillars of America that are on the table right now that never were in the past. Things like the Ryan plan that Alan West supports, basically, you know, gets rid of Social Security and Medicare as we know it. You know, it privatizes these systems. And to me, part of what has made our country so great is our middle class. And part of what's created that middle class were things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid that, you know, every American had, you know, at least something to fall back on, something that they paid into their entire life that was there for them. And they're under attack right now. And Alan West and the Tea Party are trying to get rid of those programs. So that's something that I want to fight for.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, we've got a situation right here where FPNL pays no tax, has made incredible profits, and now they want another rate increase. And it seems that there's no one speaking for the public. And we know that you're going to make that kind of commitment, and we can count on you to take our phone calls and to work for us, not just for corporate interests. I was wondering if you could address health care reform, sir.
Yeah, well, you know, it'd be an interesting week. I was expecting any day now. They said it's not going to be tomorrow. I just saw in the news, so maybe Thursday we're going to hear what the Supreme Court ultimately feels about it. But you know, any piece of legislation that increases access to quality and affordable health care for millions of Americans is a step in the right direction. And, you know, there are some very good things in the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, part of those, you know, on your show, you know, allowing young adults to stay on their parents' health care until they're 26 years old, you know, getting rid of the donut hole for seniors. Getting rid of the, making sure that your pre-existing condition still coverage. And if you get sick, you can't get dropped from your insurance plan. Of course, there's things that prove, you know, any piece of legislation that is perfect. We saw with the 1099 forms, you know, it was just too burdensome for companies and even charities that had to fill these out if they had over, I think, $600 in revenues a year. So there's some things that just were a little too burdensome for companies, but they're straightening that out. Restaurant owners were adversely affected by healthcare reform. So there's some things that do need to be tweaked. But all in all, it's certainly a step in the right direction.
Another one of the hot button issues that our good friends, the Republicans, seem to be so focused on is legislating women's rights and the women's choice that's been enshrined in law for so long. Could you address women's issues?
Sure. You know, since day one on my website, I 100% pro-choice. My finance director worked in for some time, and I'm an adamant supporter of women's rights. And, you know, what's happening right now with the Republican Party, I don't know the exact numbers, but there's something like 700 bills proposed between states. And federal bills that have proposed to take away a woman's right to choose. You know, historically, on average, you have, you know, 50 to 60 bills, and that's in the 700. I mean, that to me is unbelievable that we're really going that far backwards in our country. You know, Roe v. Wade passed in 1970. You know, this was 40 years, and people want to go back to that. So it's unfortunate, you know, what's going on. Alan West recently voted against this Violence Against Women Act, the Fair Pay for Women, those sorts of votes. I just don't understand how anybody could vote against that. And, you know, I applaud our president for his support of Lilly Ledbetter. That was my first piece of legislation he passed, was the Fair Pay for Women. So I think our president's done a great job.
You know, it's not only trying to get around Roe v. Wade. You know, there's Republican legislation to try to reduce women's access or access in general to birth control. You know, they want to refight the battle of the last century. It's such a shame that this is where they're trying to take the American attention and the hijack the legislative process to problems that were resolved, you know, nearly 100 years ago.
Right.
If you could address union rights and the rights to organize and bargain collectively.
Well, you know, I've gotten the endorsement of most of the local unions, a lot of the national unions as well. So I worked very hard for their support because, and they've been supporting me because I support working class Americans and I support their rights. I think they deserve a fair wage. And unfortunately, you know, Republicans used to hide the fact that they were attacking unions. And now what we've seen in Wisconsin and what we're seeing in the last couple of years, they're not hiding it. They're in an all-out assault to take away workers' rights. And look, I stand by, you know, collective bargaining, and I stand by my fellow Americans that want to get a fair pay for a fair day's work. And, you know, that to me is non-negotiable.
Let me ask you about another difficult question that many of us are concerned about. You know, several months ago, we heard military reports that there's no more than a few hundred Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And yet we have troops there, we have troops in Iraq, and, you know, we're hearing about pullbacks, we're hearing about pullouts. We do still have this largest embassy ever built in Iraq. Do you think it's time for us to reassess this commitment of American resources and that maybe some of these resources should be coming home?
Certainly. The fact that we're spending $2 billion a week in Iraq and Afghanistan and bridges are literally crumbling in our own country is flawed. And I think we need to constantly reassess where our resources are being allocated. And while I think the president has made some steps to bringing our troops home and resources home, I like you said, it needs to be reassessed. I think that's a good way to put it because things change quickly. You know, there's a lot going on in the region though. This is what we're seeing in Syria, what just happened in Egypt today. That there is a lot going on that needs to be monitored on a day-to-day, on a minute-to-minute basis. But all in all, we need to focus our resources here at home because we have our own struggles right now, and we need to get our own people back to work.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more difficult question, and I'm not trying to do anything more than kind of get a feel for how you view international relations. It seems that there's a strong push for military intervention in so many regions of the Middle East, whether it be this drone warfare against Pakistan, drone use in Yemen. We're expanding our Africa installations. We're involved in several of the transasiatic regions. Do you see this militarist presence of ours as a stabilizing influence or a destabilizing influence? Would you look forward to warfare with Iran or us sending troops to Syria?
Well, there's a lot in that question, so I will start by saying...
And I apologize, it's just we have a...
No, it's all valid, all good current events, things that need to be addressed and in the conversation. And bottom line to me is war is always a last resort. And we cannot continue to be in these endless wars. We are, at the same time, at war against terrorism. And, this is something I think our president probably struggles with continually, with the use of drones. And, unfortunately, this being at war against terrorism isn't like being at war against the country. It's much different, and it's constantly evolving. The terrorists are moving. And if we are going to, as a country, say that we're going to defend ourselves and fight against terrorism, then what's the next question? And how are we going to do that? And there are, of course, pros and cons. And the obvious advantage to them is our own troops, our own Americans, are not at harm's way. Drones also serve a great deal, and they help with intelligence gathering. They don't put our own, CIA intelligence officials in harm's way. They can do it from the air. So drones do have some advantages, but it is a slippery slope. There's no question about it. It does beat, bomb on a town or on a city to get one terrorist, though. These are targeted strikes. But you bring up a valid point there. Where do you start to draw that line? And you know, I think our president probably struggles with this on a day-to-day basis, but we have to stand up against terrorists, and we have to continue to fight that war if they're going to continue, you know, attacking us and threatening us.
Certainly, you address it well, I think. We do have to consider these things carefully.
You did bring up Syria. I will, you know, point out there.
Please do.
You know, this isn't a unilateral decision. This is something that the world and NATO need to get involved in. We cannot allow Assad to continue the brutality against his own people. Syria is, you know, clearly a crucial figure in the stability of the Middle East. And, you know, it's going to take the world community to take a stronger approach against them, whether that's sanctions, whether that's encouraging Russia to put more pressure on Assad. We saw last week, I think it was last week, that President Obama met with Putin in the G20 summit down in Mexico. You know, we don't know what was said in those conversations, but I would imagine that there are some strong negotiations going on to make sure that Russia does begin to put some pressure on Syria.
Well, thank you. Before we go too much further, I think before we head down that last roundup, I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, how they can give you their support, and give us your website and your contact information so they can help out a good progressive Democrat.
Sure. Well, say quickly, is I didn't get to bring it up earlier. You mentioned Alan West and his fundraising. We are currently the second highest fundraising challenger in the country, raising over $2 million. So we are going to have the resources to take the fight to Alan West. I don't want people to hear the news about his fundraising and give up. If we pull together as Democrats, we win this vote. You know, the votes are there. It's a 52% Democratic performing seat, so we can do it. And we're going to work very hard to raise the money to get the resources to get our message out. So I want everyone to know that. To get in touch with us, our website is patrickmurphy2012.com. My direct email is patrick@patrickmurphy2012.com. I look forward to hearing from you, from all of your listeners. I love to hear your thoughts and your suggestions. And we have a busy road, a busy 4.5 months here, but I'm very optimistic that we're going to pull this off. And I will point out that the National Democratic Party has labeled this as one of their, because we are in the Red to Blue program, they're going to do everything in their power to make sure that we win.
Well, that's good to hear. It's good to hear a progressive being supported for a change.
Yeah.
Too often we hear otherwise. So if I was to ask you to kind of summarize what you bring to this seat that's going to be yours, what would you say your top three priorities are?
Number one is creating jobs, getting people to work. Got to protect the middle class. Got to rebuild the middle class. And number three is working together. That's something that I think is just so obvious about what Alan West is so bad at, you know, calling someone vile, despicable, not a lady, accusing them of being a communist, telling Democrats to get the hell out of the United States. It is unbecoming of a leader, and it's such a time of turmoil. We need to work together as a country, and I have no problem reaching across the aisle, talking to a Republican that's willing about the issue and getting people back to work.
Well, thank you so much. We sure appreciate your presence with us. And,
thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We want to wish you every success. Is there any other final comments you'd like to make, sir?
I thank you for having me on the show and look forward to being back as soon as you let me. Looking forward to the end of November.
Okay. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Patrick Murphy, candidate for Congress. And we know that you're going to spend your time and your resources supporting the progressives that are working to build that better America, that same America that you're working so hard to make. And I want to take a moment to thank my colleagues in the progressive media, Gwen Holden Berry and her Here Be Monsters show, Brian Stetton and his Working for Democracy project, I also want to thank Susan Nylon and her great show out of the West Coast. And, of course, Anita Stewart. And I want to thank my colleague Amy Tidd for all her good work. She's not on air right now, but she continues to write and she continues to work. I want to thank her as well for her support. And, you know, we hear these stories. Don't let the corporate news get you down. Because there are good, hardworking progressives every day working to make this a better world. Our good Progressive Democratic Caucus is working to keep the party's foot to its fire to support progressives. And when they don't, we're there to say progressives stand for justice. Progressives stand for equality. We also want to wish our friends in the panhandle the best as Tropical Storm Debbie comes ashore. Those of us who've been through hurricanes before know what it can be like. So whether it's flooding or winds, we wish you all safety. Our colleague Cynthia Schmidt put this up on online. She said the Romney-Ryan budget would make cuts to the Pell Grant program, resulting in 10 million students losing about $1,000 in college aid. The Romney-Ryan budget would make cuts that would deny health coverage for up to 52 million people, including low-income children, pregnant women, nursing home patients, and people with disabilities. The Romney-Ryan budget would make cuts that would cause 200,000 children to lose a chance to get an early education in Head Start programs. The Romney-Ryan budget would make cuts that would take away 16,000 medical research grants a year for little inconsequential things like Alzheimer's, cancer, and AIDS, and would also eliminate support for nearly 50,000 researchers, students, and teachers. We also want to salute those Michigan legislators who read the vagina monologues on the steps of the Michigan House. Thrown out from the Michigan House for using the vagina word. Incredible. We also want to salute our friend Emily Dillick for her work. Palm Beach Now and Beyond. Next week, our guests on our human rights show will include Tony Armstrong, Meredith Ackman, Alan Hendricks, Keith from Food Not Bombs, also Summer Gentry, who works to improve the way TSA functions. You probably all heard the story about the former TSA worker who, after being roughly handled, decided that she would give the groper a taste of their own medicine. Of course, she was arrested. Well, thanks for listening. We hope you join us again next week when we do our human rights show. This is Richard Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network. thanking you for joining us. Thanking my colleague, Mickey Royce, for all her efforts to make this show what it is today. So thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week. This is Richard Spezak, Progressive News Network. Stay strong, brothers and sisters. Solidarność.